Okay, it looks like we got a full crowd here. It's 15 after, so let's go ahead and start. My name is Chris Hallam. I'm a Senior Product Manager for Operating System Security. So that's Windows Client OS, as also as Phone. As many of you have heard, we've reorganized the company around the Microsoft One initiative. So a lot of people, jobs who maybe were phone only or client only, have now been merged. So I now own responsibility across both at this point. So today we're going to talk about how Windows 8.1 raises the bar of security for your enterprises. In fact, my view, and it might be a little biased since I work at Microsoft, but when I think about security in isolation, and I cut everything else out of the product, I personally and really truly believe that security in isolation is a reason to go to Windows 8.1. We've moved the needle incredibly far forward, and you'll see as we go out throughout the presentation that's true. So the agenda for today is we're going to talk a little bit about the threat landscape. I'm going to go through a couple of slides. I call them flash slides. They're a little bit markety in feel, but there's a couple of key messages that I want to land on you, and I think that type of approach is the best way to present it. We don't dwell on it. We're talking about 7 minutes of content there. And then we're going to drill into some of the meat and potatoes, the things that you came here to listen to. So we'll start with the operating system strategy. We'll talk about things we've done in hardware in 8.1 and Windows 8, malware resistance, information protection, identity access control. Those are the three kind of key categories of security that we organize our efforts around. So with that, let's talk about this changing threat landscape, right? We've been talking about the changing threat landscape forever, but we are seeing some pretty interesting changes that are very different than what we've seen in the past. We always saw incremental change, like attackers getting smarter, but using kind of the same type of attacks, and we just more is kind of like whack-a-mole for Microsoft and all the others out there. But we're seeing really that now actually we've done enough in the operating system that really maybe your users might be a bigger threat than the attackers out there. Or your attackers will be using users to attack you. So there's kind of an indirect approach that people are taking these days. And so users, you really need to put them on your radar if you don't have it already. The other thing is that the perimeter that you put around your network to protect everything, well, that's probably gone, right? You're probably supporting BYOD to some level, maybe not with PCs, but at least with phones. And so you have a very different landscape that you're managing. And so the idea that you have domain join and high fidelity management with group policy and all these great tools that we've had on the Windows platform to secure your assets, that's just probably not there on these types of devices. You have devices that are not domain joined, for instance, and phones and different platforms, right? That's something we didn't see 7 years ago. We didn't see different platforms in your environment. It was probably all Microsoft. So you have a very different landscape within your environment, and the perimeter is kind of faded. This just gives you kind of a visual articulation. You know, it used to be the castle wall around your network. Now you just have this porous bubbles of resources everywhere. Nothing's really protected around it. It has to be protected at the resource level. Right? We protect each resource, not just the network anymore. So we'll talk more about that as we go on. So BYOD is, of course, one of the top priorities that many of you are focusing on, and it's not the only challenge that you're facing when it comes to security. The improvements that we've made in Windows, particularly in 8, and even in 7, have driven our adversaries to completely different tactics. And so this tactic now is they're just going to go log in your network as you. Attackers have become pretty adept at stealing identities. And I'm not talking about, you know, identity theft like the LifeLock scenario. I'm talking about stealing certificates, stealing passwords, stealing tokens, these types of things. Things like pass the hash or pass the certificate. These types of things which people talked about, that stuff's being executed at scale on small businesses. It's not just Lockheed Martin that needs to worry about these sophisticated attacks. These have been weaponized for the little businesses. In fact, as you'll find out here in a second, maybe the little businesses out there that you conduct your business with are maybe your biggest threat. So here's an interesting scenario. So according to McAfee, they had a study that they funded. 75% of users are using the same password across all the sites that they use on the internet. Now, your corporation, you probably have a password reset policy. That password is very likely different than what your users are using on the internet, but it may have some shared characteristics. There may be a pattern that's discernible. If you attack enough of these sites and get those password databases, you may have insight that helps you actually even get into your network. So don't think because you have a password rotation policy that you're safe. You're safer, but we still need to have some caution here. But anyway, we have this shared password problem, and so the attackers know that the easiest way to get to the high-value asset is to go after the weakest link, right? Because everybody's sharing passwords. So who am I going to go after? Well, in the city of Redmond, where I live, there's lots of little small businesses with online websites. And guess what? They have password databases and accounts, and they have all sorts of interesting information about me, probably even a credit card that's been stored on their server. So the attackers are going after these people because they're just smart enough to get a website up and running, but they don't have the resources to protect themselves. So the attacker attacks a small business, and then they hit your bank with your password and your user account, because guess what? The email account you use for your logon identity there is probably the same one you use at Fidelity.com. So this is what's happening at wide scale. And if you think about some of the high-value websites, you know, even big websites who've had complete password and user database dumps, and you see multiple of these happening, the hackers have access to all this information. They can start finding out who's sharing passwords between these sites, because they have the passwords and user accounts across many, many sites. So it's very interesting. And so once they get your bank, or they're, of course, going to be able to hit you everywhere you are. And so if you remember the Kill the Password article from Matt Honan, this is almost a couple years old. He talks about the story of himself where one password led to this journey of all of his accounts being compromised, his devices being remotely wiped, and it was a big disaster for him. So passwords are yesterday's technology. We do have to move away from them. There is a black market that is prolific and accessible. It's not just this secret thing that's hard to find. If you've ever heard about the Tor network, right, you can go access that later today if you want to, and you can start using search engines to find ways to buy and sell credit cards, passwords, usernames, and all sorts of things can be found there. Methamphetamine, I mean, it's all out there on these networks, as you probably have heard of. There was a recent credit card breach that many of you know about. I'm not going to name the company, but I'm sure many of you can guess who that is. Before I go into this, the people who work at this company, they know how to do security. They're professionals. They know what they're doing. But they're dealing with a pretty advanced, persistent threat. And they're dealing with complex, changing environments. And so I would not fault them completely and say, oh, they just didn't do security right. They did a great job with security, but they left one door open that they didn't realize was there, right? And so we should all be thinking about, you know, where we should threat model our approach to security everywhere and rethink it. So, of course, if you know Brian Krebs, he wrote the comments on this. He basically said they broke into the target's network, not the target's, but the network itself, by getting access to the, okay, cat's out of the bag on that one. But you all knew, you already read it. Anyway, I'm just gonna keep on moving on this slide, so I think you've already read it at this point. But the point is, they got access to Target's network because they compromised an account that was being used by a third party, right? We do this at Microsoft all the time, right? You probably do it. If you're giving third parties username and passwords to access your network, be scared, right? These guys need to be using two-factor authentication because they are not going to handle their identities the way your employees do. So, at any rate, let's move on. I can't believe I did that, by the way. But anyway, I'm sorry for any target people in the audience. What's interesting is Lockheed Martin kind of foresaw this when the Flame virus came out, and then later on when it was disclosed that some pretty advanced military technology had been compromised on Lockheed's and General Dynamics networks. They basically said this. They said, we are spending as much money protecting the third parties we do business with, the vendors, the subcontractors, the supply chain, all these people that don't work for Lockheed directly, they're spending as much money protecting them as they are protecting themselves. So they knew about the threat of giving identity and credentials to third parties that are not Lockheed employees. They're not going to conduct business and security the way they do. So they have a big spin on protecting the people. So I thought this was pretty interesting, but it's not surprising that a company like Lockheed would be very aware of the type of threats. They'd probably experienced them many years ago. So anyway, we have a perfect storm that we're facing. We have BYOD creating a condition where devices and platforms are coming into our environments that are maybe less secure, definitely less managed than we're used to. And our identities are under a threat that we've never seen before. In fact, I would say malware is still an important challenge, but the attackers are probably focusing more on identity because it gives them sweeping access and persistent access to your networks. So we've designed Windows 8.1 to address these threats. So that's the marketing pitch, and I hope it lands and resonates with you because we're pretty convicted that this is what we need to be building Windows around and the types of scenarios we've got to defend against. So when you think about the strategy that Windows has for business, we've always been known for enterprise-grade solutions, And we've done a great job with that in Windows 7 and previous operating systems. Something we didn't focus on as much was the devices and the user experience. And so things were out of balance. I wouldn't say that we didn't have good devices and we didn't have good UI, but we've put all our eggs in that let's make enterprise scenarios rock, and we did great there. Windows 8 was where we transitioned to a balance between these two things. And so what that means is we spent a lot more time thinking about devices, and in particular, the type of security attributes that we want these devices to have. And you'll hear about that here in a minute. And then, of course, we worked on the UI. Now, the reality is we actually, I think, bobbled the ball, at least, on the UI with Windows 8.1. But I think if you've seen Windows 8, I think we had some challenge with UI. Windows 8.1 and the 8.1 update, I think you'll see that we've corrected some of the changes or the mistakes we may have made in the UI. So if you haven't seen the new UI in the 8.1 or 8.1 update, I encourage you to take a look at it. A lot of the things that you wanted, customer feedback is built in there. And Terry Meyerson actually revealed that the start menu is coming back. So if you want that and you're waiting for that to come back for Windows, that will be there quite soon. So that's always a crowd pleaser. So we're giving what our customers are asking for back. So anyway, so let's go into to the next thing here, which is platform alignment. So I talked about Microsoft One. Well, part of the One culture is bringing all the operating systems groups together, Xbox, Windows client, Windows phone. We're bringing that all together under one house, and we have now a group called One Core, where, you know, the phone team doesn't exist, the client team exists, one team. In fact, we moved everybody to sit in the proper place, and we repurposed people's jobs. There are a bunch of people I know on the phone team who are working on like device encryption, et cetera. They don't own that feature anymore. The Windows client team picked that feature up because they own most of the code. And so people's jobs were completely repurposed, and so we actually, in some respects, have more staff working on Windows than we've ever had before because we don't have the redundancies we had. So we're going to have higher quality, better reliability, more innovation. And so I'm really excited about how this is going to turn out in the years to come. And I've been at Microsoft for 17 years. I've never seen this type of change happen. I've never seen this amount of movement of people and repurposing of people's jobs. And I have never seen a more optimistic crowd about it. You'd think if people were really, oh my gosh, I'm not working on BitLocker anymore, right? And they're all unhappy about it. No, people are really jazzed about it because they see what's going to happen. So anyway, let's talk security. I know I've been talking a lot about higher level things, but let's get into our first area of investment. This really came online in Windows 8.1. We really kind of switched in 8 to kind of a malware resistance focus. And in 8.1, we really focused on identity and making some big investments there. So let's talk about that. So let's first talk about the first threat that we want to eliminate. So if you're familiar, is anybody here familiar with Mimikatz? So we got a few people here. Okay, so I mentioned earlier this concept of pass hash. Well, now we're getting to the world of pass the certificate, right? So when I provision a certificate to a PC, I can mark that non-exportable. So in theory, that certificate can never be removed from the box unless you can own the box and then put this tool on it. This tool will allow you to export certificates that should never be removable off of the PC. But a bootkit or rootkit or some sort of app as super high-level privilege can do this. So Mimikatz is a big threat to our identities because identities are now the leading thing that we're worried about, right? So we need to eliminate the Mimikatz threat. And so the way we're going to do that is with a feature that you probably heard about, but probably only in the context of BitLocker. So TPM, Trusted Platform Module, is a standards-based crypto processor from the Trusted Computing Group. I love this feature because this gives us a root of trust for our cryptographic operations. Before, we did it in software. So if software is compromised, though that software solution isn't going to be able to do its job properly. But when I bake this in hardware and make it read-only effectively, that cryptographic processor and its capabilities can't really be compromised in the same way. So what we're using TPM to do is we're using TPM to protect the certificates that are on your PC. So we still store them, you know, there's data on the disk, but what we're doing is we're using the TPM to encrypt that certificate data. So even in the event the Mimikatz gets on the box, it can never be exported and handed to somebody else in a readable way. They'll get encrypted blob of data that's unreadable unless they put that certificate back on the original box where the TPM lives. So TPM is not just a BitLocker feature anymore. It's a feature designed to protect any sorts of data. And in Windows 8 and 8.1, we went from in Windows 7, we used it for one feature, which was BitLocker. We use it in, I think, 10 or more features in Windows to protect all sorts of different things. We even use it to like seed like ALSR for memory randomization and all sorts of interesting things there. So TPM is a big deal. TPM has been a challenge for us in that it's been an expensive part when it was built in a discrete component. We, with Windows 8, created the capability to build firmware-based TPM that can be stored in ARM Trust Zone, or Intel's Platform Trust technology. So think of those as generic security components, and I can put firmware in there, I can put firmware TPM, I can put firmware anything. And so our main focus for Trust Zone and Intel's Platform Trust technology is for firmware-based TPM. This drives our cost down to zero, and this is why consumer-grade tablets already have TPM, whereas before Windows 8, it was only in premium commercial-grade devices. In 2015, July 1st, TPM of either discrete or firmware-based form will be a requirement on every single Windows device. So it doesn't matter what form factor, an Internet of Things device or whatever, it's going to be a requirement across all these things. Right now, where we're at is any instant go device, so basically tablets, it's required. All commercial devices will have it because that's the consumer demand has driven that. And then we're going to see it, where else are we going to see it? So we got tablets, and then Windows Phone devices. They also have it by certification requirement. So pretty pervasive already, but as we move into later in the year and into next year, you won't be seeing new devices created without TPM. So let's talk about how we're going to move away from passwords. So the problem with passwords, as you know, is it's a single factor option that I know, right? And so if I know it, maybe somebody else can know it. Maybe somebody can derive it using, keyloggers. There's all sorts of different ways people write passwords down. There's all sorts of mismanagement of passwords and ways to get access to them. So with biometrics, what we're doing is we're moving to a better single factor authentication option. Now, in the future of Windows, we can move into a world where biometrics can be true two-factor, but in the short term, I'm calling it a stronger single-factor option because of this reason. There is still a password under the system. So think of this as a password stuffer. What we do is we take the password the user uses, and we encrypt it, and then we use their biometric, fingerprint or iris or whatever the biometric input is to allow that to be decrypted and then pass through securely under the hood. So the user stops using passwords and stops thinking about them, and the passwords could be, really long. You could say, hey, we've moved the biometrics on these devices, and so we now have 48-digit passwords, right? So they're only used maybe for recovery types of operations. And so in that respect, it's almost, it's very difficult to hack that type of thing. So just be aware that when you move to biometrics in the short term with Windows 8.1, there is a password under the hood that you may choose to manage or maybe lengthen because it's not going to be what users are using. Now, when we move to fingerprint-based biometrics, which is what we optimize Windows 8.1 for, there's a lot of different technologies and there's a lot of FUD out there, and so we're going to kind of hopefully demystify as much as we can in the time we have here. But there's a bunch of technologies that you're going to hear about out there. There's some really bad ones. Optical readers are really bad options. Those are just high-resolution scanners, and we need something better than a scanner to do biometrics. There's thermal readers, ultrasound readers. Those are just different ways of getting fingerprints. Those are very expensive options, and I don't see a big security benefit to going towards them, and they're just not going to be commercially viable because they'll be too expensive, at least in the short term. So capacitive readers are the ones that are going to win, and that's what you see in my device here has a capacitive reader. If you have a Lenovo or even other devices out there, Lenovo's really kind of got into the fingerprint-based biometrics world, and so they have swipe scanners across all their devices, almost I think all their commercial line. But these are capacitive, and what they do is they put a little bit of current in your finger and they take basically measurements, right? So I put a little current in, I get a signal back, I measure it, and I can tell the difference between rubber, human flesh, et cetera, and there's some other things they can do. Now, you've probably heard of different hacks. This is an image from an article in a Brazilian newspaper. There was a series of doctors who were basically doing time card fraud in this hospital they worked at. They signed in with their biometric identity, and then the clock started ticking, and they start getting paid. And when they signed out, then they'd stop getting paid. And so what these guys did is there was a group of, I think it was five or six of them, but at any rate, let's say four of them would show up to work, and they would sign in the other two using these rubber imprints of the other guy's fingers, and they would go to a football game or the bar or the beach or whatever. And so they would, they're basically committing a fraud. And so here's a better screenshot of what it looks like. It's just silicone. It's not super high resolution, but it's pretty high fidelity. So it looked like a good fingerprint. You may not be able to discern the print it would leave behind versus maybe the one you would leave behind on glass. So it was probably pretty good print. We can determine when those types of things are used with modern readers. Modern readers have a couple things. The one of the most important is has 3D analysis. So the print isn't just the 2D print, latent print that I'm leaving here on this glass. That has, you know, a two-dimensional level of fidelity. This print's going to see three dimensions. There's important information on the top of my print, at the bottom of my print, and there's even information in between, right? And so there's a lot of information in there that wouldn't be left behind on a latent print. And so these types of modern readers, including the ones in Lenovo's and others, have some of these attributes. They also have this notion of liveness detection, so they should be able to determine rubber versus other things out there. And then in our view, a truly modern reader is a touch reader. Now, I have a swipe reader because that's what's in Windows devices today. Touch readers, we talked about them last year, actually. They took a little longer to get to the market than we had hoped because the cost was, I think, a little higher than the OEMs wanted. We're going to see them show up in devices this year. That's pretty much a guarantee from at least one of the OEMs that I've spoken with, and I can't disclose who they are yet, but I'm hoping later in this year we'll be able to say who they are and maybe even announce the models with them. So we're pretty excited about moving into that world very quickly. So let's talk about how secure are these sensors really, because you've seen Apple's iTouch or Touch ID got hacked, and you saw the Samsung sensor get hacked, and so you're probably thinking, okay, Chris Helm's going to throw these guys under the bus and say why their technology Windows is that much better. I'm actually not going to do that because they actually have pretty good tech in their devices. The attackers that have exploited these sensors did something and were maybe a little disingenuous about how they projected what they had achieved. What they had achieved is they had achieved replication of their own fingerprints that they had in their own possession, and they were able to recreate high-fidelity, three-dimensional imprints using special materials that most people would not have access to, although it could be bought in the open market, but most people wouldn't know what those materials are, and they had special practices and knowledge on how to recreate those. So what this took was physical possession of the print you wanted to hack, not the latent print, but the actual print on the finger, recreation of it, and then the attack is executed. So that's not the attack that we're really worried about. We're worried about latent prints being left behind and somebody picking up my cell phone and going, oh, there's the print, now I can break in. That's not really something that they really achieved. They technically could have achieved it, potentially, and I'll leave it there because I don't have all the facts because they didn't disclose them all. But the types of latent prints that you're leaving behind generally do not have the they're smudged to some degree, right? They're not perfect prints, and these people had perfect control, and they really laid down the print that they wanted to replicate in a very precise way. And that just doesn't happen. So if I was the Department of Defense, the CIA, ISS, these types of people, I would do some more research on this to see if this gives me the level of assurances that I need for my type of scenarios. But if I'm a small business or medium-sized business, this is probably, I don't think I'm going to be a target there. So anyway, I don't want to say that this attack vector is impossible, because that's what I'm saying. But I think that the level of sophistication means that it's going to be a target attack if it's very specific, high-value targets. So let's talk about what we can do with biometrics in Windows 8.1. So the first thing is related to a problem we had in Windows 7. So we had these sensors, and in fact, this device has been around for quite a while. Came with Windows 7, in fact. In order to use this sensor, I had to go to Lenovo to get third-party software and drivers to use this sensor. And so that was enough friction that I just didn't go and do it. And not only that, Lenovo is not known as a security company, and I'm not sure if they're the person I would trust with, you know, authentication, right? That's just not their line of business. I think they probably did fine work there, but you know, this is not something that I would probably put my faith in. So what we've done is we've made sure that 100% of the middleware that you need is now in Windows. The only thing it comes from somebody else is the driver that enables the sensor to go, and we work with those companies to make sure that those drivers are properly designed and they go through the software development life cycle and the security development life cycle, et cetera. So these are high-quality drivers coming out. So we now have an enrollment experience, which I'll quickly show you here in a minute. Biometrics also can be used everywhere in Windows. Anywhere that you might have to sign in with your domain credentials, you can use biometrics for that experience. That's something you couldn't do on the previous version of Windows. The next thing we have also is we have this concept called Touch to Buy. This is very similar to what you have on your iPhone. You have the ability to go to the store, make a purchase, and you make the purchase using consent with your print rather than typing in a password or a PIN or something like that. So we have that as well. But here's a place I think where we really differentiate, which is apps. So we have an SDK, and we have a bunch of cool APIs that people can use. And I'll show you an app here and talk about some scenarios where you might want to implement this in your own line of business, or if you're working with ISVs, you might want to recommend that they adopt this functionality so that you can benefit from it. So with that, let's go ahead and let me show you a couple of these experiences here. So the first thing I'm going to show you is the, let's see here, we're going to go ahead and show you the enrollment experience. All right, so if you go under accounts, sign in, you'll see all the different options. We have things like picture password, which, by the way, I wouldn't recommend this for corporate use. If you do if you go look on the internet, you'll see that people can guess these types of passwords. Think of it as a fun way of signing in, but not a secure one necessarily. With fingerprints, I've already got one registered. In fact, I haven't used a password on this PC for a really, really long time. And I can barely remember what it is because it's been so long since I've had to use it. But at any rate, if I want to add another, all you have to do, click the add another or add new is what you'll see if you don't have anything registered there. In order to enroll a new identity, I have to authenticate with something. I don't want somebody who walks up to my PC unattended and you know, adding themselves as as myself. So I first have to authenticate. So I'll use my index finger, which is what I use all the time. And then it's going to ask me to do that. I've got to pick a finger that I haven't used before. So I'll try this one here. This is my pinky, and I'm going to register. And I'll just do this a number of times. It's going to take a couple times to get it right because I'm using a swipe-based sensor. I'm not using a touch sensor. If I'm using a touch sensor, it can take either one or two different tries. But because this is swipe and because my hand might move, they want to just make sure that we don't lock ourselves out after the end of this experience. So it can take anywhere from like 4 to 7, sometimes 8 tries. And that's very similar to what you'll see on the iPhone 5S, except you might have to do it 20 times because unlike this sensor, which has a 9 millimeter surface of width, they have 4 by 4 millimeters. So they need to make sure that when you touch enough times that they get a wider view of the fingerprint than they can get in any one shot. Our recommendation for IHVs is that they are looking at 6 millimeter by 6 millimeter, or maybe optimally like 9 by 9. Because when you do a 9 by 9, I can guarantee that we're going to get the whole print, all the information, have all the minutia data we need to do it one time. 6 by 6 is, I think, where we start saying we think that's probably as low as we want to go. Now, I'm not saying that the iPhone 4 by 4 millimeter sensor is not acceptable, but it is why you have to register a number of times, and it's sometimes why you have to try again when you're trying to sign in. So anyway, it's a little detail there. So we're all done here. So that's how we add fingerprints. Now, one thing it's pretty cool about when you go into fingerprint world is when I go to the sign-in screen, let's imagine I just rebooted this PC. What's the first thing I do? I flick the lock screen, or I hit the enter key to flip the lock screen. I go select a profile, and then I sign in. When I reboot a PC, all I need to do is provide my biometric identity. It enumerates the templates that we have stored on the PC. It says that one maps to that profile and assigns you right in. So it's kind of a quicker way of getting signed in. And if it's a touch sensor, it's even better. It's just touch to sign in. So a pretty superior user experience that doesn't compromise security in my view. Now, let's talk about the app option. So there's a couple of things you can do with our SDK. So let's imagine that you're a healthcare provider and you have an app that physicians and nurses use, and the physicians, let's just imagine, have access to more information about patients. Well, when we sign into this application, what I might want to be able to do is make sure that the doctor signs in with her biometric identity to get access to that information. Now, what you could do today is you could prompt the doctor for a password. But if there's any healthcare people in the audience, you'll know that a doctor would never stand for that, and they'd probably have their nurse sign in with their personal password, which means the password is in the clear and multiple people have it. So doctors just don't have any patience for this stuff. They're too busy. But when you use biometrics, because there's so little friction, and especially with these touch sensors, they're not going to see this as anything but a security benefit, which they actually appreciate. So you can use the SDK to implement this in your app, either on app startup, and there's also other opportunities. If there's anybody in the finance industry, what we would think you would want to do is possibly verify before certain trades are executed, maybe high-value trades this app's not running at the right. This app is a demo app, and it requires running at 16 by 900. But under the actions there, sadly, it's cropped. There's a button there that says sell all shares, right? So a high-value transaction, if I was to select that, I can say that type of transaction, those are greater than 100,000 or 100 million, whatever you want, are gated and require biometric authentication. Now, not only do I get the authentication piece without friction, I also get something else that you don't have today, which is I get a provable audit trail. Right. Today, if somebody signs in with a password, the audit is based on this assumption the password has never been compromised. With biometrics, I pretty much know that person was present when they made that transaction. And if there's a court case, that might be a substantial piece of evidence if that person's saying it wasn't me who did that. So at any rate, pretty cool stuff with biometrics, and I think that's kind of something that this is really kind of a differentiator for the Windows platform, is it's not just for unlocking a device, it's for apps, it's for Windows, it's for authentication on websites, etc. So it's a full-fledged experience. Okay, so let's go to the next area. So two-factor authentication. So we had stronger single-factor authentication, which is great. But I think that a lot of you organizations out there should be looking at two-factor. The reason why you probably haven't used two-factor, or if you have two-factor in your environment, that you aren't using it holistically across your environment. I don't know anybody, even in government, who's using their CAT cards on every single scenario. They're using it for very specific things. And so and the reason why, it's just too expensive, there's too much friction, et cetera. So that's the challenge, the cost is too high, and even though the benefit is fairly obvious. So the solution is to virtualize this authenticator option. So we talked earlier with the Mimikatz thing, that, hey, we have this new technology with TPM, I can bind those certificates to that physical device. Well, that's what a virtual smart card is. It's me receiving a certificate from some management system, persisting it with the TPM, and then virtualizing a smart card reader and a smart card itself in Device Manager. If you go onto my PC here, you'll see that those instances exist. So from a Windows perspective, it looks like a real thing, but it's technically not. And in this case, the virtual smart card is always inserted. So my device here is the physical, it's one factor, and then the thing I know is the PIN that I'm going to use. And this is easy to provision. It can be provisioned electronically, it can be revoked, and I don't have this physical thing. Now, there are benefits to having another physical thing, because there's kind of three things involved. There's a PC that I want to use, there's a thing that I have to have, which is my CAT card, and then maybe a PIN or whatever. So this does change the landscape a little bit, but what this I would say is gives us something that we can easily deploy that's better than passwords, it's better than our current implementation of biometrics, but that'll change in the future. And it's easy to deploy, and it's very cost effective. So, and for the government institutions I've been talking to, they're like, wow, this is really cool, that group of people we're not using smart cards for now, we're going to deploy these and we'll increase their security. And then for the people who really needed those physical smart cards, they'll continue to use those. It's not a one or the all or nothing thing. It can be a blended type of experience. So definitely consider that. Now, one other thing that's interesting too is we just added virtual smart card support for Windows Phone. So Windows Phone 8.1 includes virtual smart cards. And so we're going to keep on improving this technology down the road. And I think if you put your thinking cap on, you could see maybe where we go next with this. And I'll just put a seed out there. If you don't know where we're going next, go look at FIDO. FIDO Alliance out there is something that Microsoft, Google, and a number of others are working together on. And we're going to solve the authentication challenges we're facing today together with a common solution rather than disparate proprietary things. So that's good news. And this technology, if you deploy it today, can be moved into that newer world once we finalize our work with Google and others. So your investments here will not be wasted when we change things down the road. So that's what we've done with identity to improve things. So I think it's kind of spot on with the types of challenges you need to be thinking about. So let's talk about information protection. When I talk to customers, information protection is definitely the top thing that people ask about. BitLocker might actually be the most popular topic that I talk about. It's everybody's asking about it. The reality is disk encryption, full volume encryption, is going mainstream very rapidly. It used to be something that was only in the enterprise edition of Windows. In Windows 8.1, we put it in Pro. We took device encryption, which is automatic encryption. It's in every edition of Windows. The devices being built by OEMs are now capable of running this in most cases. And so it's not going to be very long until we get to a place where every device that you get out of the box is encrypted, and that the idea that you're micromanaging it with these big systems and tools, that'll probably go away. You'll probably still want to report on it for compliance, but the heavy lifting to put it into a compliant state, I think, will go away pretty quickly. Let's compare and contrast device encryption and BitLocker. So device encryption was first released on Windows RT, so Windows 8 RT, as well as Windows Phone 8. So device encryption basically is basically automatic encryption. If the device meets the proper requirements, which in the case of RT devices and phone devices will always be true, and you sign in with the right experience. So in the case of Windows RT. As long as you sign in as an administrator with an MSA account, we will automatically provision the encryption on that device. You don't have to do anything. It's just going to be there automatically. In the case of Windows Phone, we handle it a little bit differently. We implement it if the management system, MDM or Exchange, using policy says, I need that device to be encrypted before mail comes down. So it is a little different between the two devices. We'll probably reconcile that down the road, but right now that's slightly different. But device encryption, think of it as kind of automatic. There's no knobs to turn. It's just a binary thing. It's either on or it's off. Now, BitLocker is a little different. BitLocker is something that you actually go and deploy yourself. And you may deploy it in a very specific configuration. Maybe you want 128-bit encryption. Maybe you want 256. Maybe you want pre-boot authentication. Maybe you don't. There's all sorts of different things and choices you can make with BitLocker, whereas device encryption is just kind of automatic. It's just a one-size-fits-all type of approach. So BitLocker allows you to encrypt volumes, the OS volume, removable volumes, you know, any types of volumes that register on the disk can be encrypted. And it's now on Pro. That's a new thing for Windows 8.1. So you don't have to go buy Enterprise, at least for that. However, there's a caveat. If you want to manage BitLocker with BitLocker administration and monitoring, which is what most organizations would want to do, so they can do centralized reporting, self-service recovery, improved provisioning, you will need the Enterprise Edition, and you'll need MDOP, Microsoft Desktop Optimization Pack, with the MBAM product. So be aware of that slight caveat there. So let's talk about pre-boot auth. So this is an interesting conversation. This kind of brings us into maybe more of a 300-level ground. The conventional wisdom is it needs to change, right? The conventional wisdom is you have to have pre-boot authentication to secure your devices. And that was true a while ago, but that is not so true anymore. And so when you go and talk to our competition, they're going to say, we got single sign-on from pre-boot auth. You don't want MBAM or BitLocker for that. That's the first thing that they're going to say. And if that doesn't work, then they're going to go to FIPS, and then we have a solution for that. And so they'll go through their playbook. But I want you to understand when you do not need pre-boot auth. There are cases where you will need it, but you're going to know in a few minutes exactly what those are. So that's conventional wisdom. And so why have we needed it? Well, we need it because the encryption key has to be in memory, right? So when I unlock the disk, the encryption key has to be in memory because I'm going to be using that with the encryption solution as the PC's running. Well, what's the problem with having the encryption key in memory? Well, guess what? People can get access to memory, right? You can have kernel mode drivers have access to memory. You can have boot kits with access to memory. You can have all sorts of things. You can have DMA ports, other types of ways. And so if you can get that key out of memory, you can decrypt the drive. And so there are two, before I get to the two options, there are three companies, two companies and one university, Elcomsoft and Passware, are the first things you will see if you go Google or Bing, BitLocker hack. You'll see that. And they're going to claim, yep, we can break into BitLocker every time. And my answer to that is, yeah, you can definitely use these tools and be successful 100% of the time if you misconfigure BitLocker. Right? That's what those tools, and they don't really advertise it that way, but that's the reality. So those tools are not hacks or tools that work unless you make a mistake from provisioning perspective and go against the grain of our defaults. So those two tools, Elcomsoft, Passware, aren't going to work. And then Princeton EDU also has a hack, and we'll talk about that in a minute. And the two attack vectors are these. The DMA port attacks are what Elcomsoft and Passware talk about, and Princeton talked about the memory remnants. So let's drill into these two attacks. But before we do, actually, let's talk about what's bad about pre-boot authentication. Well, what's bad is I have to turn off my PC every time I walk away from it, which means it has to reboot. And PCs are a lot like our mobile phones, right? If you've bought a Windows tablet, you'll know that those things turn on instantly. They have technology called Instant Go, formerly known as Connected Standby. So they're always on, always connected, always able to receive Skype calls or new mail while the device is running in extremely low power state, and you get that long multi-day standby state with these devices. So if I have to turn off the device, well, I have to reboot it, and that can take some time. So that's one of the first reasons I don't want it. The next thing is, what about remote management? Well, that's broken when a device is turned off. And if I need to patch the device when it's turned off, that's not possible. So pre-boot auth is a bad thing, but it may be necessary. So let's talk about when it is and isn't necessary. So modern devices provide immunities. We'll talk about that. And your Windows 7 devices can be configured to be immune from most of these attacks. And there's some that you may not care about, and maybe you will. So Let's start with DMA port attack. So the way the DMA port attack works with Elcom Software Passware is they take advantage of the way a DMA port works. So a DMA port is a port that gives you direct access to memory. If you can plug a device into it, you can take all the system memory. So what these two tools do is you take a target PC, let's imagine it this one, and I take another PC. I connect a FireWire cable between them. I run Passware on the attack PC. I access memory. I dump the key. I decrypt the drive, and I'm in. This is totally trivial. As long as I have enough money to pay for the tools, I can break into the PCs this way very easily. So there's a couple things we've done to address this. In Windows 8 world and beyond, well, our tablets don't even have DMA ports. So we've restricted those because DMA ports are not really useful except to developers like maybe you who might need them for debugging these types of things. So DMA ports generally not that useful except in certain types of scenarios. So we've just made them illegal, you might say, on mobile devices like tablets and phones. So you won't see them there. The next thing you'll find is that with Thunderbolt coming down, so the typical DMA port is FireWire. There's a new one called Thunderbolt coming. And so Thunderbolt is may or may not be a hit on mobile devices because it's really designed for high I/O type of operations. It can be used for video, but we're not sure how useful it'll be on mobility. But regardless, what we've done is we've worked with Intel to create the condition where newly attached devices to a Thunderbolt port, the drivers for those devices will not be loaded until a user authenticates on the PC. So if I did that scenario where I got an attack PC and I connect it, that device doesn't get DMA access until I go to the target PC and I sign in. And at that point, there's no point to the attack PC because I've already got direct access to the box. So we've broken that attack scenario for all future DMA port types, Thunderbolt being the first instance, and there will be others down the road. Now, for your existing Windows 7 devices, my feedback that I'm receiving is that most people are not using FireWire, but you almost all have them. You have these devices out there. New devices will not have FireWire. They may have Thunderbolt in the future, but FireWire is kind of a thing of the past because USB 301, that type of battle. So what we recommend customers do is look at your use cases for your users. And if you don't see people needing the need to use Thunderbolt or, FireWire, just disable the driver, and that attack vector is gone. If you have a small subset of users that need access to that port, because you got a special video capture type scenario or a video device, then what you can do is you can use a feature that very few people remember called device restrictions. So there's a group policy option that you have. It's called device restrictions. And you can basically say that this particular ID for this particular device, this camcorder or whatever, it gets access to this device. Everything else is blacklisted. So you can basically do a whitelisting of the devices you want to use, and that might be a very small subset of your users. And that's pretty manageable. Scenario. So if you're worried about FireWire, I think you can turn it off in most cases, and we have a solution for those who still need some limited access to it. So I think we've solved that one. We've pretty much nailed that one out of the park, I think, in my view. So the next one is a little different. This is the Princeton EDU attack, and so this is what we call memory remnants. And so what memory remnants attack is what happens is my PC is running right now, my memory's hot, I've got my encryption key there. When I turn off the PC, the memory will remain resident, even with no power, for maybe a second or a few milliseconds or whatever. Well, what if I froze the memory? Would I get the ability to persist that memory for a longer period of time? Well, the answer is yes. Turns out that I can persist the memory that's there for maybe 10 minutes or longer, or maybe even indefinitely if I have the right tools. So what the attack that Princeton did is they took a laptop like this, they popped the bottom of the case off, they found the memory chips, they used an aerosol can to freeze the memory. They then turned off the PC, so now it doesn't have power. They took a small operating system that they put on a USB drive, they put that in the USB port, they turned back on the power, the F12 booted to USB. That operating system had one goal: find the encryption key in the frozen memory and then dump it. And that's what it does, and then they were able to decrypt the drive. So that is a highly reliable attack vector, easy to perform. All you do is go to Princeton EDU and grab the tool that they've got out there. But there's a way for you to mitigate that. On Windows 8.1 devices, that tool doesn't work. And why is that? It's because UEFI doesn't allow startup of untrusted operating systems, right? Princeton's little operating system isn't signed. And even if it was, its signature will not be sitting inside your UEFI database unless somebody hacked that first and put it in there in the first place. And then you got bigger problems. So on modern Windows 8 certified devices, that tool does not work, period. On your Windows 7 devices, our recommendation is something that we've been recommending a lot but most people don't do, which is lock down your BIOS with a password and prevent booting to USB. Because if I can boot to USB, I can do all sorts of things to your PC. I can put boot kits on them. I can do all sorts of mischief. So that's something maybe you only want to allow people to do when they need support scenarios and these types of things. And there are authentic or there are legitimate uses for booting to USB in some devices. But in the Windows 8 world, again, that's totally fixed. So things like Windows to Go will automatically work on those types of devices. So there's one last variation of this that's worth knowing about. It's non-trivial, but it's for full disclosure. We want to make sure you walk away with this knowledge. So what some people have done is they don't use the Princeton operating system to boot and get the key. What they do is they freeze the memory. They take it out of the device physically. They put it into another device that they own that maybe accepts the same type of memory, or maybe it's a device that's just designed to read memory. And then they get the key that way. Well, it turns out the Canadian Department of Defense did some work on this and research on their devices that they had within their organization at the time. And what they found is that it was incredibly unreliable on the devices that they had that hack would work. It just didn't work very often. They also found, and this happened about 6 or 7 years ago, that there is a correlation between the density of the memory and the likelihood that would work. And so if you think about the density of memory today versus 6 years ago, I'm sure that it's higher by magnitudes of order. So my speculation is that attack is even less reliable today. That attack requires a higher level of sophistication, a very, very motivated person. If somebody leaves a device in a taxi cab, I don't think they're going to pull that out of their playbook and do that. That's something I think the Department of Defense would be concerned about, and maybe others who are doing business with government and others. So, you decide for yourself if that's an attack vector that you're worried about. But that's one that we don't have a mitigation for. We just can tell you that it may or may not be reliable on your devices. One device it won't be reliable on is a tablet. Tablets have fixed memory, and phones have fixed memory. So you'd have to desolder the memory off the board and get. In the case of Surface, you need to unscrew about 50 screws to get to that memory. So this one, I'll let you decide from here how important that is to you. So anyway, net, if you think you need pre-boot auth with BitLocker, think again. I think that more people than ever don't need it. And as you move towards a Windows 8 world, I think it will quickly become a legacy thing. So let's move on. Let's talk about a corporate wipe scenario. So something that you've had on mobile phones for a while is the ability to kind of wipe these remotely, right? You got email on it, user gets terminated, you wipe your corporate data off of it, and that's gone. Well, we now have the same type of capability on Windows. So with BYOD devices, with an MDM, you can basically have the user enroll in this management system. They'll be able to receive company apps, corporate data, policies from you. And then in the event that the relationship between you and this person, or maybe just the device, maybe the device is lost, when that relationship ends, you can remotely wipe that data and toss it in the trash can, as we have here. So this is something that we've had on phones for a while. We now have it on our Windows devices, all editions as well. So an exciting new technology there. Let's talk about app control. Now, this is an interesting one. I wasn't sure whether we should put app locker on information protection or malware resistance. It really can serve both purposes. What a lot of customers are concerned about is untrusted apps accessing, being run on their devices. And so we've had AppLocker in Windows Enterprise Edition for quite a long time, actually. I think it's been, maybe it was Vista, I don't recall exactly. I think it was 7. But at any rate, most customers were not using it. And what AppLocker allows you to do is allows you to basically whitelist and blacklist apps. Right. Now, it can be challenging to do this, right? Because you can imagine whitelisting. Who here has maybe thousands of line of business apps in their organization? Okay, so it's quite a few people actually. So, whitelisting 1,000 apps might be problematic. So, I think when you are a large enterprise with huge volumes of apps, or your users need the ability to run everything, AppLocker might be a challenging technology for you to use. You might look towards something like Bit9, which is a competitor to AppLocker, which I think allows you to deal with those larger scale scenarios. But for those of you who don't have thousands of apps, you might find that this is exactly the solution that you need. And from a malware resistance perspective, AppLocker would give you the ability, I think, to basically drive your malware numbers pretty close to zero, right? Because if you don't let untrusted, unknown software running on your PCs, you basically have eliminated the potential for malware to run on the PC. Now, that doesn't mean that you'll never get malware on the system. There could be vulnerabilities that lead to exploits that disable App Blocker, but I think that some of these drive-by types of things that people experience in the browsers and whatnot, I think you can eliminate a lot of these and drive your malware stats down to almost near zero. In fact, if you have thought about Windows Phone 8 or iOS, they don't have malware on those devices. And the reason why is they don't let untrusted software to run on those devices. So I'd recommend that you think about whether something like App Blocker could help you better protect your data, prevent people from using Dropbox and other cloud resources, but as well as drive your malware numbers down. So let me just show you, for those of you who haven't seen App Blocker, let me just quickly show you what that UI looks like. So App Blocker is based on policy. So we're going to go into, you know, group policy editor, and you're going to drill into computer configuration, Windows settings, security settings, and then under here, under app control policies, you'll see App Blocker. And so it's really easy to create these rules. And the way we make it, the thing that's nice about BitLocker that some other similar types of technologies ran into trouble with was, well, what happens when I get a new version of an application from a company, right? Well, if I'm using hash-based whitelisting, that means I got a new set of binaries with a new set of hashes, and that means all my rules break. So what App Blocker offers that some of the competition hasn't, but not all of them, but some of them hasn't, is the ability to create rules. So let me just step back here. So the way I create a rule, let's create a rule for an executable. And let's say I want to just go and trust anything from Microsoft Corporation, right? If it's signed and it comes from Microsoft, I don't even care what version it is. As long as it's signed, it's from Microsoft. I'm going to go ahead and trust it. I could do the same thing for any other company that's signing their binaries. So I go ahead and go under the executable rules node, create a new rule. This just gives you a quick set of instructions here. I can now say, you know, what kind of rule do I want to make? Do I want to create a deny list, or people often call a blacklist, or do I want to do an allow list, a whitelist? So let's go ahead and just do a whitelisting operation, or an allow list. I can select, well, who does this rule apply to? Is it everybody, or is it maybe just specific types of users? And then here's where our rules can be resilient as apps change. So I can use a file hash as one option, and that might work well for an application that maybe I built myself that's never getting revised, and maybe it was never signed, right? So maybe this is good for legacy, but for modern apps, which are very likely being signed, I can select publisher. And then I can set the publisher here. And what we do to make it easy for you is we allow you to reference a file to get all this interesting information. So let's go ahead and select IE. So my goal here is I want to get that Microsoft publisher information, which has now been stripped off of the IE binary. And then I'm going to go ahead and say, I don't care what the product name is by putting a star. I don't care what the file name is. And let's just leave the file version, but I could say any version. I could say greater than or below, et cetera, so I have some options there. I can do some exceptions. So if there are certain exceptions I want to apply, certain people who shouldn't have this type of rule, et cetera, I can do that. I give it a name, my rule, and then I can create it. And so because I'm creating this first rule, it's going to say, hey, there's some other rules you probably want to create in addition, some default rules. Do you want us to create them for you now? I'm going to say yes, and now I've got all the rules I need to make sure that, in this case, everything running under program files, everything running under the Windows folder, and anything signed by Microsoft will run. Everything else is in the deny list inherently. So we've locked down the system pretty quickly with this. Now, the problem when you use App Blocker or app control technologies like this is you may not have good visibility into what your users are using in your environment, right? So if you deploy this, you might get a lot of feedback, right? Suddenly people can't run their apps, and they're really really ticked off, and you're really killing productivity in the bottom line, potentially. So what we have is we have an auditing mode, and this is what we recommend you do. Create the rule set that you think makes sense. Run this in audit mode. Leverage the eventing that we bring back. Look at the apps that are running. Decide, are those apps I want to put in the allow list, or should they be in the deny list? Update your rules, you know. Get more comfortable with that list, and then start, you know, deploying it to certain groups, slowly, iteratively bringing it out, and then you can get that environment contained. If you do the boil the ocean thing all at once, you're certain to get some really, really bad feedback and some feedback from your manager saying bad planning. So, and you don't want that. So anyway, so take a look at AppLocker if you haven't done that before. Again, it's available in the Enterprise Edition of Windows. So let's switch gears into malware resistance. My clock didn't start, so I'm a little, let me do a quick time check here. We got a little more time. Okay, so let's talk about malware resistance. So as I mentioned before, in Windows 8.1, we focused on identity. We did some information protection stuff. Windows 8 was where we made this huge push on malware, and I think we've just completely transformed the malware situation on Windows. So let's talk about the investments that enabled that. So the first threat that we wanted to address in Windows 8 was this threat of firmware, hardware-level boot kits. So Mabromi and MyBIOS are examples. These are boot kits where they basically replace the firmware of your BIOS and augment it with additional malicious instructions. There may be option ROMs on like a video card or other devices you have in the PC. Maybe they replace those. And the challenge there is from the desktop, very likely your anti-malware solution can't find these. They may be able to, but many times they don't detect this type of stuff. So in most cases, this is going to be undetectable threat that persists maybe forever on your device. And so what Mabromi was actually designed to do was it was designed to help other malware get loaded on your PC and for it to persist. So what Mabromi really does is it basically goes and it tampers with your boot sector and your MBR to redirect it towards malware that hopefully will get down on the box later on through other means. So it's about persistence, right? So this is the back door they have to always bring themselves back when AV cleans up the mess. They don't clean this one up, and then this thing brings it back. So, and again, so because it's in firmware, it's very difficult to see. So our solution for this is a technology that you've probably heard a lot about called UEFI. So think of UEFI as a modern day replacement for traditional BIOS. UEFI has all sorts of benefits, fast PC booting, it's architectural independent, it's on my phone, it's on my PC, it's on my Internet of Things devices. So it's a great solution for all types of devices. From a security perspective, its primary benefit is a feature called secure boot. So secure boot basically creates a condition where only a trusted, properly signed operating system whose signature is sitting inside the UEFI database can start on that PC. So that Prince Nidiu thing, this is what prevents that from starting, is UEFI secure boot. And so this basically eliminates the potential for boot kits to start after your BIOS initialization, so something before Windows, which is what most boot kits do. It also prevents the Mabromi thing because the UEFI firmware has to be signed, and it can't be updated with unsigned firmware, so it can't be replicated like a Ward BIOS had this problem. That's what Mabromi was taking advantage of, is the fact that it didn't have to be signed to be replaced. It also will not start devices on the PC that have option ROMs that will consume unsigned firmware. So basically, these places where malware can hide, those devices don't get initialized on a UEFI system, and the first software that starts on your PC will be Windows, or it will be the Linux distribution that's trusted by UEFI, or whatever. So this is this is not a defense. This is like an architectural solution. Boot kits are gone with this, outside of the possibility that maybe there's a vulnerability in the UEFI component itself, but it eliminates this risk factor. So once we have a secure startup of Windows, the next place boot kits would attack is within the Windows boot process. So if you think of the boot process being a series of things that are starting up, malware always wanted to start up as early as possible, because the earlier you start, the more control you get on the PC. So Allurian is a very famous piece of malware. It's a boot kit. It might be coupled with Mabromi. They might be working together to persist each other, or Mabromi would be helping persist Allurian. What's interesting about Allurian is because it was a boot kit, and boot kits are very difficult to detect from AV software and other systems, because those boot kits typically disable those features or tamper with them so they can't do their job. We only found out about this when somebody reported a vulnerability in Windows, and we fixed it. So what happened is, it turned out, somewhere in Windows we were using a hard-coded memory address, and somebody found a way of exploiting this. So we're like, okay, well, we got to add ALSR there. So we added ALSR. Now the memory was random. And so this Allurian virus was taking advantage of that hard-coded memory address. It knew about it. It exploited it. And once we changed it, the memory being now random, we started blue screening PCs once we deployed this patch. So we only found out about this once we broke this boot kit, because it started blue screening the PC when it was present. So eventually we figured out what was going on, and we're like, wow, this is interesting. So that's how we found out about Allurian. And this is how like people like Kaspersky and others find out about a lot of this malware. It's very difficult to detect, right? So at any rate, so the way we prevent Allurian and others like it is with a feature we call Trusted Boot. So once Secure Boot at UEFI level starts, so think of that as a hardware feature that starts up Windows. Now Windows is starting. The first set of code that's going to run is basically Trusted Boot, and Trusted Boot is going to prevent any third-party code from starting until Windows is started up successfully and the anti-malware solution is started up successfully. So you're no longer going to have the condition where malware starts in the middle of the boot process and before AV and then turns off everything. You're going to have a system that's running, that's got its defenses up, and now has a fighting chance at preventing a low-level boot kit. So the feature that we use to protect the anti-malware solution is called ELAM, Early Launch Anti-Malware. You need to, when you run, go to Windows 8 or greater, you need to make sure that the anti-malware solution you have is using this feature and you deploy that version. You do not get to take the benefit of Trusted Boot unless they build a specific driver. And the driver is built by them, and then they submit it to us, and we sign it, and that's how they insert themselves in the boot process successfully. We want to make sure that third parties that are not trusted can't inject themselves in there. So Trusted Boot protects the remainder of the boot process. This is the old world on Windows 7. Two vulnerability points. One is starting the OS loader. The second is third-party drivers that are tampering with everything afterwards. Windows 8, everything is signed across the boot process. Those attack vectors are gone. So boot kits and root kits on Windows are, you know, I can't say that we won't have them, but this is a big hammer on this solution, and so we're pretty excited about the results here. Now, what happens, though, if somebody takes advantage of the fact that all of this is based on trust, right? This whole system is based on trust. It's based on signatures, and those signatures are assumed to be trusted. Well, what happens if somebody compromises our signing certificates and signs their own malicious binaries with Microsoft's signature? Well, guess what? Those binaries are going to run just fine on this PC. So we have a mitigation for that, something we call Trusted Boot. And we're going to talk a little bit about that later, but think about Trusted Boot as taking integrity measurements, hash measurements of everything in the boot process, and then persisting that using the TPM, and then we can do remote analysis of that, and we'll talk about that here in a minute. So we even had a mitigation that somebody compromises our certificates. We got a solution for that. So once I got a PC that's booted and it's booted secure, well, where's the malware going to go from there? Well, it's going to run on the desktop. And so when we move to Windows 8.1 world, we have a new type of app. We have apps that sit inside a sandbox. So unlike Windows 7, where every day app is using Win32 APIs and it can run with high privilege or no privilege, right? There's just all these different options. Every app that runs in the app container world, or it comes from the Windows Store and uses our new runtime, sits inside a sandbox, and that sandbox limits its access. That app does not have access to the system unless you grant it access to specific capabilities. Like, yes, I give this app the ability to use the GPS, or I give it access to use the camera, or I give it access to the file system. You give it just like the things you've seen on iOS and Android. But we have this container. It also has negotiated communication between apps. So apps in Win32 desktop world have unfettered access to other apps, so they can exploit vulnerabilities in other apps. In the Windows app contained world, you can't do that, right? There's structured communication between apps, no more, no less, right? So it isn't unfettered like we have. So these apps are way more secure. And so when you start thinking about the apps of the future and the line of business apps you're building in your environments, when you deploy Windows 8.1, you should be optimizing for the WinRT runtime, which is not to be confused with Windows RT. I'm sorry that marketing made that hard on you, but the WinRT runtime inherently gives your app the ability to take advantage of the app container. So sandboxed apps. So you want to optimize and index on that and start moving away, where possible, from desktop Win32 APIs. Now, there may be cases where it makes sense to build desktop apps still, but think about, can you do that and use the WinRT runtime wherever possible. The other thing that makes things more secure is we have everything coming through the store. So all Windows Store apps come from the Windows Store, or if you build them yourself, then you provision them via sideloading. So when you move to a world of sandboxed apps and everything coming from either yourself or from the store, you have devices that don't have malware anymore. Not that it's impossible to have malware, but if you look at the malware stats on iOS, Windows Phone. Windows Phone actually leads. Possibly that's a factor of market share, but we've got great numbers on Windows Phone. iOS has great numbers. Android does not have great numbers. Most malware is targeted at the Android platform. I think that Cisco reported that 90+% of malware on mobile is targeted at Android. And it's because they don't have the containment model, they don't have the store model, although they have a store, but they don't have the processes in place to keep those stores free of malware. So let's talk about Windows Smart Screen. Or actually, let's talk about the threat before we get to it. So CryptoLocker. So over Christmas, everybody's talking about CryptoLocker, all right? So if you're not familiar with that, that was a piece of malware. I'd go to a website, get tricked into installing this thing, and then now my family photos and music and all my personal information that I care about is now encrypted. And if I want to unlock it, I have to use Bitcoins or my credit card or go to 7-Eleven to get, I forget, there's some payment system that they have there. But I'd have to go get some form of payment to get my content out of jail. So this is a pretty frightening threat, and so we have a great defense, and most people don't realize how impactful this defense is. Most people think that preventing malware is about antivirus software. The way I think about antivirus software today is that's your backstop. When all the other defenses in front of it fail, it's there to clean up a mess after it happens. Windows Smart Screen is an app reputation service that prevents malicious software from even being downloaded your PC in the first place. So Smart Screen was part of Internet Explorer 8 and 9 and 10 and 11, of course. And so what it did is it uses an app reputation service and heuristics to determine whether that's an app that should be trustworthy or not. And if it's on the blacklist that we have, then you're not going to be able to install it. And if you're an IT organization, you have a couple options. You can either give the user the choice. Right, so we'll put a speed bump up in front of them saying, hey, we don't know if you should trust this binary, or we know that this is malicious, do you want to continue? IT has a policy they can set that says, you know, if it's not looking good, do not allow the user to install it at all. So there are some choices you can make, but this prevents the download from even happening in the first place. So it's pretty powerful, and this blocks 97% of the malware that's being encountered on the internet is being blocked with this, not your antivirus solution. So this is your frontline defense. So Smart Screen, very powerful feature. Something that we did in Windows 8 is we moved Smart Screen out of Internet Explorer and we put it into Windows itself. Because the problem we had was twofold. One is because it was only an IE, people using Chrome and other browsers did not get the benefit of this. And if you look at NSS Labs stats on app reputation services, we lead there. So we do a better job. They do an okay job in other browsers, but we do a little bit better. But you weren't able to take advantage of that. So in a way, we were kind of people running Firefox and other browsers, they may have been paying a penalty, at least in that area, for it. So what we decided to do, and also, well, what happens if somebody gives me a USB with a binary? And that, well, I'm not in a browser, so it would run anyway. So we moved this service into Windows Core, and now no matter what path it comes in, through the browser, through USB, through email, IM, whatever communication channel, it always gets vetted by the service, and it will get blocked. And so this is blocking, is according to the stats that we have, 97% of malware encounters are blocked with this service already today. So then we, of course, have the backstop. We have Windows Defender. In Windows 7, you went and got a spyware specialized version called Windows Defender. We upgraded this to become a full-fledged, McAfee, Kaspersky, Symantec-compatible anti-malware solution. It's in every edition of Windows. And now we're going to be able to take care of one of the biggest problems we have, which is it turns out that I think it's over 30% of devices out there are not running active anti-malware for a number of reasons. One, they never installed it on Windows 7, or B, they're running a time bomb or a trial edition of another product that is expired and now they're not protected. So now with Windows Defender in the box, you have a higher assurance that that people will be protected. Now, I have a session on malware resistance. We go into some of this stuff later today in more detail, and we talk in detail about a report that came from AV Test that said when you compare Defender versus McAfee and Symantec, that it's not as good. And so I don't have time to go into the details, a very technical conversation. We'll go into the methodology about that and why our numbers look lower compared to them. And I think if you attend that session, you'll come out and say, oh, okay, I understand why the number's lower, and I see that actually Defender actually is competing well against those products, even though that test doesn't look like it does. So I encourage you to come listen to that if you can. But what I will say is the methodology they used has some flaws in it, And if you come to the session, you'll know exactly what those flaws are. So my ask here for you today is just attend the session, or at least keep Defender and Skep in your consideration. Don't rule it out at this point. All right, so let's sum it all up. So when we look at these malware resistance features and we kind of combine them all together, how impactful have they been? So we've got some pretty good results. So on Windows 8, we don't have 8.1 data yet. We're still waiting for enough data to come in through our telemetry system. But for every 1,000 PCs out there that were that are in contact with our services, we're finding that 1.4 of 1,000 are getting some sort of infection at some point. When we compare the rate versus 7, it's 3.5 times higher. And I think because bootkits and rootkits are eliminated, we've reduced the type of malware you're experiencing in that 1.4 is not as dangerous, potentially, right? That it's not as persistent, et cetera. So we've really ruled out some of the nastiest ones. Cryptologger is still a horrible thing, right? That's not going to be prevented by any of our bootkit protection. But I think a lot of the advanced persistent threats have been eliminated. And if you are still a person struggling to get off of XP, it's 6.5 times less likely to get infected with malware there. So I think we've got some pretty good results with those investments. So what are people saying? I want to take some questions here. So you know, you can read these slides, but we're getting analysts, researchers all saying great things about Windows 8.1. One thing that I think is worth mentioning is that middle one from IOActive, Chris Valasek, very prestigious guy. He's a hacker. He says the delta of capability improvement between XP and 7, so think about that, that's three total OSs. We've made the same amount of leap forward with one OS hop, 7 to 8. So that's a pretty big deal, and that is not surprising because we put a lot of resources on this problem for this release. So what's the conclusion in our view? Windows 8.1 is a game changer when it comes to security, and it's a reason all by itself to move forward. So with that, let's take some questions before we run completely out of time. If you could come up to the mic if you have one, that would be great. Go ahead, first question.
Yeah, with the Mebroni virus, mm-hmm. Once you get this virus, what is the best way to remove it using tools out there if it's in the UEFI?
Right.
I mean, obviously Windows doesn't pick it up. How do you pick this thing up?
Well, Windows can't detect it from the desktop because it's running kind of under the hood. So in the UEFI world, you won't have this type of malware because UEFI prevents it from happening. But if you have a BIOS, a traditional BIOS, using something like Windows Defender Offline and Symantec and McAfee, all have these offline tools that you boot to a USB or a CD drive, and they'll have the ability to scan the firmware.
Do you guys also find setting the UAC to the highest level helps people from downloading these extra? Because we bring a lot of, like, people bring in their computers into work and stuff like that, and we constantly are cleaning up computers before we even let them back on. And it's just a waste of time, and we're just trying to find something that works.
Yeah, I mean, USC, never turn that off. I mean, that's...
Well, I mean, turning it way up, I mean, we put it in the highest level, back to the Vista level, more or less, where it bugged you every 5 seconds?
You can do that. Now, the problem is when you increase it, you're going after a very small percentage of the threats and increasing the user friction. So while that would be effective in addressing some of the threats you may encounter, those might not be the ones that actually are coming to you. So you'll introduce a lot of friction, and it may not address the specific attack. So it may or may not be effective in your particular circumstance. In theory, hypothetically, if you're encountering everything, yeah, it would bear fruit. But it's really going after a small set of malware out there. I hope that helped. Great, thank you. Next question, please.
Yeah, we're looking at implementing some least privilege management tools into our landscape, mostly Windows 7, some Windows Vista, and Windows 8.1 is emerging. Does AppLocker give us any reason not to go with some third-party tools, or it doesn't really? Maybe it doesn't seem that sophisticated yet. I'm not sure. What's your
Well, AppLockers are just about preventing or allowing apps from running. If you want to change the permissions that an app actually has, there are tools out there. Sounds like you're looking at one right now. Which one were you?
Well, we're looking at Beyond Trust,
yeah.
Viewfinity, and one or two others.
You know, those can be effective solutions. You know, it's something we don't really have a solution in Windows like those. You know, we have things like UAC, we have some other things, but if those are not giving you what you need, something like Beyond Trust might be a good solution.
Okay.
It's very different than AppLocker. What was that? I'm sorry.
you actually do have an API for blocking that in that filter driver for processes.
Yeah, I'm sure that's the API they're using, yeah. So.
It sounds like we're on the right track.
You're definitely on the right track. Yeah, it's a little different question than the last guy who spoke, where you're going after a narrow, you spend a lot of money and you're going after an increasingly narrow set of threats. It can definitely add value, so I don't want to say it's not a product worth deploying.
Yeah.
But realize it's not an end-all solution. It can reduce friction and cost as well. Windows 8.1 might be a better solution, maybe.
Thanks.
All right. Next question.
Two quick ones. Is the smart screen enabled in 8.1? If it is not, then where do we enable it?
So could you repeat the question? I'm sorry, I didn't hear it.
Smart screen?
Yes.
Is it enabled in 8.1 by default?
Absolutely.
Okay. And from what I heard, running IE as the app in the app container is more secure than running IE on the desktop on this 8.1?
Yeah. If we have two browsers effectively. They run the same code, but when run in the modern immersive shell, it's in the app container, whereas on the desktop, it's not. So you'll be more secure online using the immersive browser.
Thank you.
Yeah. I'm not sure who's next. It's this gentleman here.
Yeah. With the app blocker, when you're dealing with applications that deal with, I guess, third-party vendors, and then it's a dependency for the application to run, what's your recommendation going about that to prevent, you accidentally locking down or locking out an application that needs to run that's used by a trusted application?
Okay, so the question is, I've got application A and it has a dependency on B in order for it to run.
Right, and you don't know about B, and B, just happens to be untrusted, and that prevents the user from executing application A properly.
Yeah, yeah.
How would you go about that?
That's a good question. So the solution we have for that can be kind of tricky. And when you move to the Windows 8 world, we have apps that have manifests, and so it's very discoverable what app dependencies exist, and you can easily manage it that way. In the Windows 7 world, what we do is we recommend you run AppLocker in the audit mode. And so when a user uses that app, you will effectively find out what all the dependencies are, but you'll have to munge the event log to determine that. So that's your solution for
thank
now.
Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. Great. I think this question is next.
So basically the question is about pre-boot authentication and competition. So what they're saying that if you don't do pre-boot authentication, the system is accessible from the network, right? So, and you can connect it to some router and try to access admin shares and all those kind of things and try to pull the data from BitLocker encrypted machine. So as far as I understand, we're not going to be investing in any pre-execution, pre-boot authentication in BitLocker or MBAM technology. So how do you think we should be mitigating that risk?
Yeah, so the question is related to, if I don't have pre-boot authentication, I have devices that show up on the network and then they can be attacked remotely forever is effectively the question. So, yeah, this is the last. So when we've gone through all the things I've talked about, this is the last place people go. I don't put it on the slide because I think it's always a messy conversation, right? Because I think you start getting into this hypothetical attack vector, right? So I don't know if I have the best answer for this right now because it is a tough question. I think the reality, though, is that most of your devices are going to be on the network already. So they're already under that threat. And yet you allow them to run. So to say that pre-boot authentication is required to prevent network attacks is almost to say, my devices were never secure when they were on the network, and for that reason, maybe you see where I'm going.
It's a little bit
sarcastic, but
right.
It's...
They're talking more about the device gets lost, and they can attempt to connect to that device from any network. But that's, you're absolutely right. There is, if firewall is misconfigured, that in a domain, in a public network, when it switches automatically, when it doesn't see the domain controllers, it should be completely locked down, right?
Yeah.
So that pretty much mitigates that.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the scenario where I would probably use pre-boot auth always, it's almost like a joke here, but if it's got nuclear launch codes on it, right, I have zero tolerance for that device because somebody will put it in cold storage and they will attack it offline forever, right? So that device, people will spend millions, billions of dollars to try to get at that device. If you're any other scenario, and maybe that's not the only one, just think about what are your attackers willing to do to get your data on that device, and I think that'll lead you into the right direction towards pre-boot. You could use an encrypted hard drive.
Not going to help in this case. If it's, there is no,
it would be running
authentication. It's, not necessarily. It can just talking about those drivers that hardware encryption that kind of assists. It's the same thing as any TPM. You define that policy. So what Microsoft recommends is not to use free boot authentication, and it's pretty much the same situation if you use it or not. I think we're talking about different.
You actually don't. The way the drives are working now, you don't need pre-boot auth in that sense that you're talking about. So the way the newer drives are working, Opal V2, but his attack was a little different. His attack isn't on the encryption. His attack's on a device that's running with the available to the network. But e-drives don't, or encrypted hard drives don't necessarily do that. They can. If they're configured with pre-boot. Yeah. You could. Yeah. You could, but you could do the same with software, I guess is my point. Yeah. Okay, is there another question?
Yeah, the one thing I didn't see you talk about, which if I understand you correctly, I thought would be pretty big, is the LSA protected process that came in 8.1.
Yep.
Like that seems to be the single biggest feature out of all of them, to me at least.
It's a nerdy feature for sure, and I'm not calling you a nerd, by the way.
That's one
that just doesn't resonate with people. But no, that's the feature that you're talking about. The way our processes worked before is you could inject code into any running process with our protected process mode. The only way you can we talked about this a minute earlier. The only way you can inject code into another process is if you're signed and basically have the right privilege. So it's a very powerful feature. But I thought it might be a little deep for this one.
Is it as good as we think it is? I mean, just the TechNet stuff is vague, I guess, in some of the readings of it. And
yeah.
It's like, is it? I mean, today my understanding tests seemingly it stops maybe cats in its tracks.
I mean,
today is that something you think it's going to continue to do, or they're going to get around it, or
practically speaking, it'd be easier to get kernel mode access first than to get at those processes.
Yeah, I guess the way I look at it, that feature is there's a long list of features like it. There's ALSR, there's DEP, there's protected process, there's 50 other things. In combination, they provide a big, taking advantage of a vulnerability is pretty hard with all those things combined and working together. But I think it kind of was outside the scope of the level of altitude we want to hit for this presentation. But here's what I will say. If you take ALSR, which we talk about in the next session, and you look at the type of malware threats that we've had on Windows in the past with respect to vulnerabilities, ALSR broke every single cookbook technique that we've ever seen on Windows 7. There are improvements there, right? So all the old exploits, they don't work, and they can't work because they've been engineered out. Now, that doesn't mean we won't be hacked with a vulnerability, but the reality is there were literally 24 attack approaches that people used on Windows 7. And so what an attacker did is found a vulnerability. I got my list of 24. Does that one work? Does that one work? Does that one work? And then they'd use that one, right? Well, now all 24 of them are broken, so they need new recipes, effectively. And so we're pretty excited about the ability to exploit vulnerabilities on Windows 8 is dramatically less. It requires a whole new level of IQ. It's no longer some smart MIT student. It's going to be like a team of people working together for a really long time trying to come up with new techniques. So, yeah, very interesting feature you've just mentioned, for sure.
Good.
Yeah.
Last question.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry.
You go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Okay. Is the virtualized smart card implementation, is that done through a login provider, or is that a new kind of driver authentication method that's added on to existing systems?
No, I don't have an answer to that question. I'm trying to think what they would have done. Yeah, I can't derive it on the fly. It's a smart card virtually. I don't know exactly what's under the hood making it go.
Right. Okay. So it's another user remote component?
No. All right. Well, thank you very much. I hope this session was useful for you. I have my next session in a couple hours here, so if you're interested in malware, we'll double-click from this last session into that. Great. Thank you.